welcome. This is the Advisor Pact Monthly Session. I'm Mark Little. Each month we get together and we talk about how to advance your Advisor Pact pledge. These are the four things that affluent clients claim they cannot find anywhere at any price from a financial advisor. So this program is all about talking about how to implement truly comprehensive financial services in a way that truly impresses ideal clients. Man, we're going to get into some pretty big issues. Each month, as I receive questions from members of the program, I handpick, I don't know, a couple. It depends on how many, how long I think it's going to take to cover the content. But this month, I selected two questions that I thought were particularly revealing. One is, well, I think both are somewhat advanced. So I will warn you, as we go through today's content, if I cover terminology that you have not yet come across in the Advisor Pack Monthly program, just be patient. You receive at least one project a month. At some point, you'll get projects that will clarify all the terminology that I'm going to cover. But in addition to that, one thing you can also do if some of this terminology is unfamiliar is start going backwards in these monthly webinars in terms of going back and watching the replays. We always recommend to new members each and every month, go back and, you know, block time on your calendar to go backwards in time and review the monthly sessions that that maybe you missed, or if you didn't miss them, they were before you joined the program. I think we've been told by members of the Advisor Pack Monthly program that the most valuable asset in the program beyond the monthly projects are these webinars. And so the fact that you have full access to the archive of past webinars, I just recommend that you take advantage of that and start going back through them. So let's get right to it. The first question that I wanted to deal with today came from a financial advisor that's fairly advanced in our program, has gone through many months of modules, and has a pretty basic question. The thing that appealed to me about this question was it applies to almost every financial advisor, and it doesn't matter. In our program, it doesn't matter what kind of financial advisor you are. So we've got financial planners, we've got money managers, we've got investment planners, we have tax accountants, estate planning lawyers. It really doesn't matter who steps up to be the most trusted advisor in a client's life. The members of this program are from all areas of personal finance. But this question is one that is worth talking about because it's a paradigm shift. What we recommend and teach in this program is completely different than what the industry teaches. And there is a project on this. There is a monthly project on what we're about to talk about here, but consider this a preview. And I think I'm going to give you the thumbnail sketch. So the question is, Mark, how do you define financial plan in the Advisor Pack monthly program? What does a financial plan look like? Is there an example of a well-written financial plan for a client? And do we show the financial plan to the client? Okay, so let me start off with the premise. The premise is that this term that you're throwing around, this term financial plan, has no meaning. Okay, so our job in this program is to save you time. And so here's a gigantic time saver that we've already done for you, and we do it periodically, and that is... If you don't believe us, then go check it out yourself. But if you just want to take my word for it, we've updated this as recently as 2 weeks ago. Go try to get the term, try to get a definition of the term financial plan on the internet. We looked at all the major financial planning associations. We went to the Certified Financial Planner website. There's a website that the CFP folks have for potential clients to kind of explain to them the difference between a certified financial planner and anybody else that they might be working with. And they do describe the financial planning process, but there's no clear agreed upon definition of what you're asking for. And that is, what is a financial plan? What does it look like? Let's see a sample plan. There are different theories on this. But the point I'm getting at is it really doesn't matter. It means different things to different people. So it means different things within the industry. So if you asked a certified financial planner versus a tax accountant or maybe an estate planning lawyer, any skilled financial services professional will have an opinion in their mind of what this term financial plan means and would probably give you an answer if you asked that anybody who's, skilled and experienced in our industry the same question. Say, what's a financial plan? What does it mean? What does it look like? Show me an example. And my point is, you line up 10 industry people and you're going to get 10 different definitions. Likewise with the clients. Clients are a little bit less specific because they have something in their head of what they want in terms of an outcome. But again, this term financial plan means different things to the different people. Now, a client may even ask you point blank, will you be creating a financial plan for me? But all I'm saying here is that what they've got in their mind when they say that term means something completely different from what you probably have in your mind. Therefore, what we acknowledged years ago, I'm going to say 15 years ago, is that this term has no meaning. It has no agreed upon definition. It has no standard for what you're asking for. What does one look like? What are the components of it? And what does a well-written plan look like? This is not agreed upon. And so therefore, we don't use that term, financial plan, anywhere in our system. Now, when we're talking about a financial planner that you add to your team, we may use the term financial planning. And I think you could possibly bust me on this. I think I may occasionally use the term financial plan, but only in the context of what we're about to discuss, which is to explain the fact that we don't use that term. So if ever I use the term financial plan, it's like I am right here. It's only in the context of trying to explain to you why we don't use that term, because it will confuse clients. All right. So we do teach a different concept, and in the Advisor Pack Monthly program, the concept that we endorse, that we have tested over time, and that we can tell you with authority, this is the way to do it with affluent clients, is to approach this from a different perspective. And to consider it as you as being the most trusted advisor in a client's life, it's up to you to make sure that every one of your ideal clients has a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. Now, that's the term that we use. So basically, let me give you a refresher. If you're new to the program, it'll be new. If you've been in the program for a while, this will be a refresher. Let me just walk through how we recommend within the monthly projects that we send out to you, how we recommend building your team. All right, so the Advisor Pack model, financial services model, is quite different than the traditional financial services model. In the traditional financial services model, the ideal client is coordinating everything themselves. Okay, so if they have a tax accountant and an estate planning lawyer and insurance agents and all these financial people in their life, in the traditional financial services model, it's the ideal client that coordinates all those people. And if those people ever talk to each other and coordinate among themselves, it's usually the client that's driving that. So in our model, it flips that whole concept upside down. The ideal client, your ideal client hires you as the most trusted advisor in their life, and then you turn around, according to our methodology, you'll go out and build a team. You'll acquire what we call subject matter experts onto your team, and you'll have a tax subject matter expert. You'll go out and acquire a money management subject matter expert who does specific things. You will hire a financial planner. And most of these are, it's one of two models, and we don't care which one you use. It's either you hire them like as staff, or you acquire them as contract labor. And that's how most trusted advisors start off in our methodology, is going out and finding professionals who are already skilled and already experienced at these narrow fields of finance, and you just hire them on a contract basis to serve your clients. Now, in addition to tax, money management, and financial planning, we have estate planning, and you'll also have an insurance subject matter expert. Or in our model, we teach several insurance. There, it's unlikely that you'll find one individual that has all areas of insurance, that they're an expert. And so in our model, we recommend that you go out shopping for insurance subject matter experts, and you acquire the ones that have expertise in various areas: life insurance, health insurance, disability, general insurance or property and casualty, long-term care. So you've got all these different kinds of insurance. And all I'm saying is, as you interview insurance subject matter experts, you'll pretty quickly determine which areas of insurance they are truly experts in. And you keep interviewing until you have all the areas of insurance covered. But then once you've got this small team of, let's say, two or three insurance subject matter experts, one of them will emerge with leadership skills in your mind, and you'll nominate that single individual to be your insurance subject matter expert, who's the team leader in the area of insurance. But the point I'm getting at is, this is your team. It's a different model than the traditional financial services model. The client has a single, simple point of contact. That's their most trusted advisor, which is you. You then, in turn, have a team of subject matter experts covering all the five areas of personal finance. And this is your team. They work for you. All right. So this, back to this term, a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy, we use that term in lieu of the term financial plan. And since in our system, all five subject matter experts are involved in the creation of this thing that we call a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy, since all five of them are involved in creating this, we don't provide a sample, but we do lay out a template for them and for you. Okay, and the reason we do it that way is because since the way we teach you, when you get the project that describes for you how to build your team, since your team, if you're following our methodology, is comprised of highly skilled subject matter experts who already have their own way of doing things, we specifically don't want to micromanage them. So we don't provide them with a sample. We don't say you have to do it this way. We understand that the reason they were invited onto your team, if you're following our process, is because they've already demonstrated they've got a robust process in place. They have a certain way of doing things. And frankly, you're hiring them because of that. So they have their own way of doing things. So we don't want to micromanage them. But Here's the guidance or the template that we do provide for the creation of this comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. So let me start with how long it takes to create this thing that we call a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy, which we use in lieu of the term financial plan. Well, we give your team in our process, in the three-meeting process, we give your team 104 days to create this thing that we call a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. All right. So where do we come up with 104 days? That's a little over a quarter of a year, just slightly over. And the way we come up with that is, we recommend that you rigidly follow the three-meeting process. And the way we come up with 104 days is that there's 14 days between your initial client interview, the first meeting with your client, and they hire you. You invite them into the ideal client community. They accept and they hire you. And then there's 14 days later, you have the implementation meeting. Okay. So that's where, in essence, your team has just simply looked over their documents and created a kind of a master list of documents that are still needed in order to do the job. And so you start making sure and gathering everything that's missing that your team needs to create this comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. Then 45 days into the process, you kind of pause and you sit down with the client. You give them what we call an initial progress update meeting. And this is where your team, I think the way I always describe it is at this point, which is 59 days into the process, that's 2 months. That's quite a long time for your team to have your client's documents and be working with them. At this point, and in my experience with our team and in looking at and serving other advisors like you around the world, the team is, you know, about 80% completed with the plan. So at this point, you sit down with the client, you have an initial progress update meeting, you kind of give them a peek at whatever's been created up to that point. If 80% of the comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy has been completed, well, then you sit down and share that initial progress with them, with the client. But that's 59 days into the process. At that point, you clarify whatever's still needs clarifying. Some usually in that first 59 days, your team in the process of doing 80% of the plan of the strategy for the lifetime strategy, a bunch of additional questions arise, like, you know, what is the client's perspective on this? Or, you know, given this set of circumstances or hypotheticals, how would the client, react in that situation? So there are a bunch of questions that often are arised, and that's what you nail down in the initial progress update. So the purpose of the initial progress update is to share what's been done over the first 2 months, and it should be significant. Like 80% of the strategy should be completed at that point. But, you know, you utilize that meeting to, you know, get whatever you're missing. So again, you know, you get the answers to all the questions that now have arisen. And then your team has another 45 days until the initial comprehensive safety review meeting. That's the 104 days. That's how we get 104 days. So at that point, your team's responsible for completing this thing that we call the Comprehensive Written Lifetime Financial Strategy. You, as the advisor, review it. And if it's up to your standards, then you approve it and you release the client into the what we call the routine 3-meeting process, where you then meet with the client every 4 months and keep this Comprehensive Written Lifetime Strategy, financial strategy, updated at all times. So this whole 104 day process at the initial, you know, the initial 4 meetings with the client, this is the 104 days that it takes your team. So yes, at this point you approve this thing that we call the Comprehensive Written Lifetime Financial Strategy created by your team of subject matter experts. But the question is, what is it? What is it that I'm approving? What are the components of it? All right. Here's where, in our methodology, this process differs from the typical financial planning process. So the starting point for this thing that we call a Comprehensive Written Lifetime Financial Strategy, it does have specific components, and the starting point is the merger of all of the following. So each of the 5 subject matter experts creates a plan. There is a customized tax plan. These are strategies and tactics developed for this client by your tax planning subject matter expert. So there's a customized forward-looking plan. You know, here's the plan as far as taxes are concerned. And that's created by your tax planning subject matter expert. Then there's a customized estate plan. That's after the review of the wills and trusts and powers of attorney and the estate plan. This would be written, documented strategies and tactics developed for this client by your estate planning subject matter expert. And then there's money management. So there is a plan, a documented written plan, a customized plan, money management plan, which is strategies and tactics developed for this client by your money management subject matter expert. And then there's a customized safety plan. Now, in academically, when we're studying this area in colleges and universities and also in the financial planning certification process, we call this area risk management. But in our concept and our methodology in the Advisor Plat Pack Monthly Program, we flip that around and we get your team and you focused on, you know, the bigger picture. So what's the other side of risk? Rather than create a customized plan addressing the risks, how about a customized plan designed to increase the safety of the plan, which as a component of it includes the plan to address risks? So this is the strategies and tactics for mitigating all risks and for increasing the safety of the client's strategies that are developed for this client by your insurance subject matter experts. Okay, so then you've got these four plans: tax, estate planning, money management, and safety. And then in comes your financial planner. All this is then wrapped up. I would call this a wrapper around those four plans. So it's truly a collaboration of these five individuals with the financial planner as the team leader. So number five is with a customized financial plan wrapped around all of the above. See, so the only time we ever use the term financial plan is in the context of your financial planner. We don't define it for them. We understand that a financial planner has their own concept, their own opinion, their own template for what a financial plan is and what it looks like. And in our methodology, this would be strategies and tactics developed for this client by this financial planning subject matter expert. But in addition to what they would normally do, they would pull together and coordinate all of the above. So you've got these other four plans, which the financial planner has to read and absorb and understand, and the financial plan, whatever the heck that is, defined by your financial planner, which I don't care how they define it. That's up to you to determine when you acquire your financial planner. This is a question that you ask them, you know, but the point is they have something that they've never had before. They have four written documented plans in each of the areas of tax, estate planning, money management, and I would say insurance, except for it's a plan to increase safety. So then your financial planner takes all of that, and then they kind of take the plan across the finish line. They wrap all that up. They create lifetime capital projections. They do their deal that they normally do. They pull all this together and then finalize and establish a plan to accomplish and focused on what financial planners typically focus on, which is accomplishing the goals. So it's the financial planner that focuses specifically on the client's goals. The client has provided goals with target dates. There are four elements to every goal, and so the financial planner takes those goals and establishes a plan, wrapping up the other four plans into this big thing that we now call a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. Now, again, these five components are just the starting point, so let's continue. What else is there? So after that, then, there are actually five elements of this thing that we call a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. So here is, I'm going to tick them off for you here. This is the punch list or checklist that should be used by you as a trusted advisor at the end of the 104 days of every client relationship to ensure that everything actually got done in this comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. All right. So it's your job as the trusted advisor to make sure your subject matter experts did everything that they were supposed to do. Now, here's your checklist. First thing is that all the five plans above that we just talked about got done. And that, I can tell you, when you first start building your team, there's a little bit of an adjustment period. Neither the subject matter experts nor the in the four areas, tax, estate planning, insurance, money management, those four are not used to usually documenting a forward-looking plan with specific recommendations, strategies, and tactics for this client. Typically, those four are not used to drafting this plan. So there's an adjustment period where, you know, they have to figure it out. Now, I don't want to get into it here. It's not the purpose of this forum to talk about that. But I can say this, this is the test of whether or not you truly have a skilled subject matter expert on your team or not. For those four individuals, the measure of whether they're skilled or not in part is when they come to you and say, so what is this plan supposed to look like? If you were to look them in the eye and give them zero guidance, just say, I thought that's something you're supposed to know. You know, if I were to say, You need to sit down and document all the strategies and tactics and customize a forward-looking plan for this client based on their situation for all the, you know, issues relevant to this client over the course of their entire financial life, you know, what would it look like? Can you figure that out? And the answer is, if they're sufficiently skilled, they obviously can. It really doesn't matter whether or not they've ever done this before. They can do it. It's just something they've never thought about. And frequently, and this is also a measure that, you know you have the right subject matter expert when they think about that and they go, well, I've never done that, but that's a really good idea. And so over time, there is an adjustment period, but you know you have the right team when they acknowledge that this is the correct way to do it. And then the financial planner comes in and wraps all that up, focusing on the goals in this thing that they define as a financial plan, defined however they want to define it. And that's part of the acquisition process for that single subject matter expert that we call the financial planning subject matter expert. So we don't have a definition, but it's important that they do and that you assess what that is before you invite them onto the team. So you have all these five plans wrapped up in something that the financial planning subject matter expert wraps together, coordinates all these plans, and creates something that is focused on the client's goals and financial objectives. Okay, so the second thing on the checklist or the punch list is a lifetime capital projection. This is, I won't go through the definition here, but, you know, just a short definition, a short understanding of it would be a year-by-year projection with starting balances and ending balances of the client's assets for that each and every year, showing inflows and outflows. So if the client's got money coming in to the plan and money coming out of the plan, maybe each year they're spending money to live their lifestyle, they're paying taxes, that money's going out. But if they're funding goals, like certain years of their life, they're going to fund goals. Obviously, the years that they purchase vehicles, though, that money would be coming out. So it's just a lifetime capital projection is a year-by-year schedule, starting this year, going all the way out to the end of the plan, whatever year that is, determined by the financial planner. And it shows all inflows and outflows for the year. So you have kind of a starting balance of the client's assets at the beginning of the year and then at the ending of the year. And then it shows how much money came in and how much money went out. That's a lifetime capital projection starting this year, going out to the rest of their life. Then there's a cash reserves plan. This is a plan which there is... in your monthly projects, you will get instructions on all of these elements at some point. So if you have not received the monthly project focusing on any of the things that I'm listing here, just don't worry. Work through these projects as you receive them as quickly as you can. And then at some point, you'll get all these various projects. One of them will describe the cash reserves plan. In essence, it's how much does the client need to keep in cash reserves for contingencies. So if their house burns down or if they lose their job or they lose their business, you know, how much cash do they need to keep in reserves? What's the strategy? It should be a written strategy with including a target amount. So your team, namely your financial planner, usually, but some oftentimes in coordination with the other subject matter experts, certainly. So the, you know, the tax expert has opinions on this. Certainly the estate planning attorney might have some opinions about this. And I think the insurance subject matter expert definitely needs to be involved in this cash reserves plan. If you, like many trusted advisors, believe that the insurance deductible or the retention amounts for insurance policies need to be kept in cash reserves in case the insurance is triggered at during the course of the year. But whatever, a written cash reserves plan is part of the checklist of this comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy, as well as a debt plan. And not every client has debt. So if you have a client that does not have any debt, obviously there is no debt plan. But if a client has a mortgage or any other debt, then there needs to be a plan or a schedule, both a written plan as well as a schedule for ultimately reducing and ultimately eliminating debt at some point in their life. So whatever, there should be a debt plan. That's number four on the checklist. And then finally, number five is each of the five subject matter experts must maintain an assumptions page. So I'll give you an example. A moment ago, I said the lifetime capital projection is run out to the end of the plan. So there is a point at which your financial planner is assuming the plan is over. So what age is your financial planner assuming that the client is dead and gone? Or I guess said another way, at what point does your financial advisor believe that even if the client ran out of money, it wouldn't matter at that point? So there is a year that your financial planner has in mind for that. An assumptions page would list all of the assumptions, including, I would say, just hypothetically, just giving you an example, the inflation rate that's being used, the growth rate that's being used. Lately on assumptions pages for financial planning, I've seen things like one, inflation rates being used for healthcare expenses at a higher rate, and then the rest of a client's personal expenses are being inflated year after year at a different and lower rate. But all these assumptions, and then the money manager would have assumptions, the tax accountant would have assumptions used in their plan. So I'm assuming this plan assumes, and the assumptions page is typically a list of bullet pointed assumptions that each subject matter is using that their plan. So each of the five of them are creating a plan for the client that's, you know, combined by the financial planner. But nevertheless, there are five plans. So therefore, each subject matter expert needs to have an assumptions page, which describes all the assumptions that are being made, you know, for the plan. So all those assumptions need to be documented. Now, that's the punch list or checklist. That's what a trusted advisor will run through once at the end of 104 days, all of these five things are completed and checked or ticked off the list to the trusted advisor's standards. So it needs to be at or above the trusted advisor standards. Once all these five things are ticked and checked off, then the plan is done. Now, in addition to these elements, these are the internal elements, there are some client reports which are created alongside those five things, which are the things that are shown to the client. So in addition to those five things, there are some client reports that have to be created. Here they are. And again, I'm going to throw around some terminology and jargon that if you don't know what these things are, I can promise you that you just need to be patient, and you will receive a monthly project at some point, which will lay all this out for you in great detail. But there are five reports that are updated, called the five critical reports. And what they are, just imagine this. If that term five critical reports is not familiar to you, then picture this. What if each one of the five subject matter experts had a simple report that would update the client on their narrow field of finance? So the money manager would have a one pager that's updated and shown to the client, and that would help the client understand the sum total of the money management. Likewise, the insurance subject matter expert would have a one pager that would summarize all the insurance area for that client, and the client would feel fully updated in the area of insurance by looking at that one pager. Same goes for estate planning. What if the estate planning subject matter expert created and updated and kept current a single one pager shown to the client, that when the client sees that one pager, they fully understand their wills and trusts and powers of attorney without having to go back and open up and read through their wills and trusts, which most clients don't do very often. And then same is for each of the five subject matter experts. So you have financial planning, money management, insurance, tax, and estate planning. Those are the five areas. The five critical reports are simply a simple report created by each subject matter expert designed to help the client understand their area and update the client on their area of finance. So if you give these five critical reports to the client and they're updated, you know, theoretically, the client would feel more or less fully updated about their financial planning, their money management, their insurance, their tax, and their estate planning. I mean, this is something that's never been done before, but the five critical reports are proprietary reports that we provide to you and give to you and teach you as to how to teach your subject matter experts to create these things. And that those are client reports which have to be created before this comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy can be checked off as completed. The second is the GPS, which is one of the five critical reports, but it definitely has to be updated every 4 months. I pull this one out as a separate item, even though it's one of the five critical reports, just to point out to you that it is every action item and recommendation envisioned by your team of five subject matter experts, including you. That makes six. For the entire life of the client. So the GPS are all the action items required for this client at as far as things that we know right now, but going out for the rest of their life. So theoretically, if nothing changed, if world events and the financial markets never changed, if the client's own circumstances never changed, this greatest probability strategy being updated every 4 months for the three prior to every meeting in the three meeting process, what it would mean is if nothing changed, the client could take this one document, and if they just did everything listed for every year of their life, then they would accomplish all their goals and they would make better choices about their finances in all areas, and they would have no financial surprises, and they would take advantage of every financial opportunity that's predictable. So that's why this one is so important. There are also three progress reports. That is presented to you in one of the monthly projects. I can name them for you, but just know that there are three of them. There's a goals progress report. There is a progress since inception report showing it's if the client says so how have I done since the first time I started working with you? And then there is a progress since last meeting report, which you will use in each and every meeting every 4 months, just to show the client the progress that's been made since the last time you sat down with them. So there are three progress reports. You have to check that off and tick those reports off before you can consider the comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy is done. And then there's the goal blueprint. So the goal blueprint is a one pager strategies and tactics for explaining the funding for each individual goal. So there's one. So how many of them are there for each client? Well, it depends. A client that has five goals is going to have five copies of the goal blueprint, one for each goal. If a client just has two goals, then there are two goal blueprints, one for each goal. So that's the goal blueprint. And then there's the Truth in Fees report. Again, this is a project that you'll get down the road. It's in essence two reports that have to be updated at least once a year. And one report is, it's basically what the client's paying, and then it lists all their holdings. So this would be commissions, fees, internal hidden expenses. It's a listing of all their holdings, and it just fully discloses what they're paying. And then a separate report listing every member of the team, and starting and including you. So you and the tax accountant, and the estate planning attorney, the insurance agents, even the auto and homeowners insurance agent. It just lists everybody on the client's financial team, and it's your estimate of what the client's going to pay over the next 12 months to each of those individuals, even if it's buried and hidden inside the products, like the insurance agents are somehow compensated through the insurance. But it's your job. See, one of our promises is transparency. Well, this is these two reports are the two reports that clients claim they never get anywhere from any advisor. This is one of the things that will significantly differentiate you in a radical way from every other financial advisor in your community. So the Truth in Fees report has to be completed in the first 104 days. And then something that we don't really define, but we do recommend, I have always included this on the checklist for the Comprehensive Written Lifetime Financial Strategy, and it is something that I just call the Document Location Report. Think of it as just a simple spreadsheet listing every document that's referred to anywhere in the Comprehensive Written Lifetime Financial Strategy anywhere. So if the client has wills and trusts and powers of attorney and an auto insurance policy and a homeowner's insurance policy and life insurance policy and a annuity, and they've got tax returns going back the last 10 years, let's say, they've got, you know, money management, they've got statements for their accounts for each of their, let's say they have 10 accounts in different institutions, all these accounts, they've got statements for those somewhere being stored. Think of the document location report just as a listing of every item that's referred to anywhere in this strategy and where the original is located or where it can be found. If it's online, it'll be a link where to log in and find it. But take, for example, the example I always use is the powers of attorney. So power of attorney kicks in if the client's unable or unable to manage their own affairs. So let's say the client's in a car accident or something, and now whoever's named by the client to take control and pay the bills in their absence, now the power of attorney kicks in. So so the person named by the client goes to the bank and says, look, I'm trying to get control of the client's bank account so I can pay their monthly bills and all that kind of stuff. The bank's going to say, I need to see an original. And so the question is, when you need it most, are you able to find these documents? Where are they? And so that's what a document location report is. It just lists everything and where it's located. And as far as updating this, this is an annual process. All five elements, including all the client reports, are updated at least annually, and some of them are updated every 4 months every time you meet. So the greatest probability strategy, the progress reports are updated every 4 months. The gold blueprint is typically updated once a year. The truth in fees is updated once a year. Document location report seldom changes, but it's updated whenever the location of a document's moved. Anyway, these are all the five elements are updated as needed and at the very least on an annual basis. So here is the checklist, the five elements and the client reports. This is your one pager which shows what a financial strategy looks like, a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. These elements are what we use as a concept in lieu of the term financial plan. I will tell you that this is... so then the question is, do I show it to the clients? And the answer is no. Your client does not receive a copy of the Comprehensive Written Lifetime Financial Strategy. It's actually in a set of in series of internal documents that your team uses to execute. I would say, what does your client need with this? But what they need is the financial advisor may choose to share the reports that are created with the client. So I kind of go back to this snapshot. The five elements up above are internal. These are the internal things that are necessary for the team to execute. And the client reports down below, these are the things that as questions arise and as the trusted advisor in the meetings are trying to convey to the client the progress that they're making, it's these reports that are, they're not shown at every meeting. The greatest probability strategy, the GPS with the recommendations and action items, is updated every 4 months and shown to the client. So are the progress reports. But everything else is pulled out as needed. It's just sitting in the advisor's stack of documents that's prepared. But the point is, the client is given these reports down below. And I've been doing this for 30 years. I'd be hard-pressed to tell you how many clients have looked, for example, at the GPS, the greatest probability strategy, which is updated every meeting, and it lists every action item required to accomplish the client's goals. Well, I can't tell you how many clients have looked at that and said, this is the financial plan. And I'm like, if you say so. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to argue with them. See, in their mind, they have a definition of what a financial plan is for them. If the financial plan is the series of all the action items required to accomplish all their goals and listed, and I've listed every action item for the rest of their life, if they want to think of that as their financial plan, that's fine with me. Same goes for the goal blueprint. There's one of those for each goal. It's got the strategies and tactics for the funding of each individual goal. I've had clients look at the goal blueprints and say, so this is the financial plan. And I'm hard-pressed to argue with them. So I would say, if you say so, I mean, that's fine with me. The point is, this is the comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. The reports are what clients see. And I can tell you that as the client consumes all these reports over a 12-month period, your client will be completely satisfied that they have seen more of a financial plan than most financial advisors share with their clients. Okay, next question. During the last session, you described advisors implementing the Advisor Pack method who charge clients between $20,000 and $100,000 per year. That inspires me, and I'm curious. How does the Advisor Pack method vary between a client who pays $20,000 a year versus a client who pays $100,000 per year? And secondly, how do client expectations vary between a client who pays $20,000 a year versus $100,000 per year? This program is great. Thank you. I'm not aware of anywhere else a financial advisor like me can get direction on issues like this. All right, so let's go through it. Here's what I covered last month, and I walked through it in quite a bit more detail, but just the bottom line was I talked about, you know, let's think in terms of what advisors using our system charge their clients. Now, I do not track, nor do I have any data or information about advisors in the Advisor Pack monthly program. However, we do track advisors in our other kind of the more advanced program, the Trusted Advisor Toolkit. We do track it over there. And so I can tell you that advisors implementing this method in our more advanced program, they charge their clients per year somewhere between $20,000. That's on the low end. That's the lowest that we have an advisor on our system charging their clients, $20,000 per client per year. And at the high end, we do have an advisor charging clients, charging his clients $100,000 per client per year. The average being the mean being, or mean being $25,000 per client per year. All right. So the question is, what's the difference? Well, I want to go through something that's quite advanced, but I'm going to walk you through it anyway. I made the decision to go through this with you, and it's something that it's proprietary to the Advisor Pact method. It's something that you have to understand if you're going to deal with affluent, successful clients. And we call it the six fundamental laws. It's interesting. These six fundamental laws were developed since 2009 by, of all people, it's Conversations, and it was the process in building the software that we have in our more advanced program. So we have the father of that software is our chief technical officer, who's a world-class software engineer, a guy named Ian Hood. So it's kind of funny. These six fundamental laws came from an outsider of our industry looking in, but you know, they had a good insight because they had to build the software around this methodology. Anyway, what came out of that is the six fundamental laws. And notice it doesn't say for financial advisors or anything with the financial services industry, because you'll see as we go through this, these are six fundamental laws that transcend industry. I mean, this is true certainly in every service industry, these six fundamental laws. And I would contend they're true in industries that have hard assets as well, like products instead of services. But let's just go through them because the context of your question is, what's the difference between a client paying $100,000 a year versus a client paying $20,000 a year? So the first of the six fundamental laws, I'm old enough and geeky enough to call this the prime directive. This is the one thing that if you do understand it, the rest will unfold quite naturally and will make perfect sense to you. If you struggle with this or you reject this, then none of this will ever make sense for you, because this is the prime directive. This is what I call the prime directive. This is the number one most important of the fundamental laws. Everything kind of comes back to this, and it is, just think in your own life if this is true. If you want to impress somebody, anybody, the only way to do that is to have your standards exceed theirs. All right. So I want to deal with something head on here. So you're sitting here thinking, wait a minute. What does this mean exactly? It means exactly what it says. If you want to impress someone, your standards have to exceed theirs. Now, we talk to advisors frequently who say things like, you know, my job is to meet or exceed my client's standards. And that's where you run like running into a brick wall. That's where you run straight into this first fundamental law. There is a substantial difference between meeting a client's standards versus exceeding a client's standards. All right. Let me tell you what the difference is. Because if you don't get this clear in your head, you'll never get referrals. So let's say you've set up your business model to meet your client's standards, meet or exceed. So that, you know, the lowest standard, the standard you're willing to accept from your team is that we're meeting our client's standards. Meeting your client's standards is a strategy not to get fired. I would go so far as to say that if all you're doing is meeting, if that's your goal is to meet your client standards, well then you're, what you've, in essence, the translation is you've set up a business model not to get fired. So obviously a client is hesitant to fire anyone if you're meeting their standards. No question. So that's fine. The point that I'm making is that for most advisors, especially advisors in our program, the goal is not just not to get fired. The goal is to be delivering services at such a level that it impresses your clients enough to introduce you to people that they care about and they know. So in other words, it's a referral-based strategy. And the point is that if you want to build a model that does more than just make sure you don't get fired. If you want to build a model that really envisions referrals, in other words, a business model where your calendar is filled with people that have been potential clients that have been introduced to you by well-served clients, the only way that happens is if you set up this business model so that consistently you're focused on knowing whether or not your standards are exceeding theirs, and that's the goal. It's not to meet your client's standards, it's to exceed, because the objective is referrals. Now, the thing that most financial advisors think about, kind of consumes their thoughts, is where's the next ideal client going to come from, or where's my next client going to come from? And if you want the guaranteed outcome of our methodology, is that at some point your clients take over that marketing responsibility for you. And imagine your business when at some point you've gotten to a tipping point and your calendar is literally filled with potential clients that you're meeting with, all of whom were just handed to you by your clients on a silver platter, unsolicited, spontaneous referrals from clients. These are referrals that were given to you from clients without you asking. All right. So that, in that world, if that's your goal and that is the guaranteed outcome of this program, then your objective for the first fundamental law is not to meet your client standards, but to figure out how to exceed them. And by the way, acquiring clients using the Advisor Pack method requires no sales skills whatsoever. As a matter of fact, in our methodology, we reject sales. Now, I'm not saying it's because sales doesn't work. Sales tactics actually absolutely do work. Matter of fact, I was trained the first 12 years in the industry. I mean, I was hired by a Wall Street-based firm. I was trained in sales. I mean, that was my upbringing. So when I say we reject sales methods and sales tactics, it comes from experience. And that is something that you're not persuading people to be impressed. You are simply impressing people because of the manner in which you're delivering your services to them is in such a way that it exceeds their standards and therefore impresses them. And I will tell you that clients are actually very simple. When it comes right down to it, I promise I'll get back to this issue of the difference between a $20,000 client and a $100,000 client. But clients at the end of the day, all clients are very simple. They want a financial advisor who is competent and who is worthy of trust. And if you're unwilling to make the effort to discover a potential client's standards and then exceed them, then don't bother trying to serve that potential client with the expectation that you're going to get referrals or that they're going to introduce you to anyone, because, that requires figuring out their standards and then exceeding them. So the second fundamental law is that there is a client experience, and whether you know it or not. And the client experience is the only way your client ever knows which standards you actually live up to. So every time you interact with a client, your competence is on display and is being judged by the client. So that's every interaction, every email, every voicemail, every phone call, every meeting, including how organized your office appears when clients come in. Every staff member, every desk they see in your office, is it spotless with practically nothing on top showing tremendous organization, or is it cluttered with all kinds of stuff falling off the edges of either your desk or somebody else in your office? The point is, every interaction, including interactions with your team members, matter. All of these comprise the client experience. And the client experience is the merger of those two things I said that clients care about. That's competence and trust. So competence shows up through the experience that you deliver in every interaction. So the better the client experience, the better your competence shows up in every interaction, and the more impressive the client experience is. I can tell you that advisors who are aware that there is a client experience and work to improve it, those are the ones that have clients who report back as having the better client experiences. And the worst client experiences are reported by clients. The more likely it is that we discover a financial advisor who is either unaware of this thing called a client experience. They just don't think about it. They have kind of a procedural process, and they don't think about the experience from the client perspective. Or it's an advisor who doesn't care about the client experience that they're delivering. They either don't realize, typically they don't realize that this is how their competence is being judged. But regardless, there is a client experience. And the third fundamental law is it's all about the client. And it's the client's standards that determine the client experience that you need to live up to. So what you think is good service, or what your team or your team members or your own advisors and coaches, what they think is good service, none of that matters. It's all about the client. It's what they think. That's the only thing that matters. And your own personal standards are irrelevant. All that matters is that your standards exceed your clients, if your goal is to impress them. And anything less is going to be unimpressive to them. And I would just point out also that making a big deal out of anything you provide, which doesn't matter to that particular client, indicates to the client that your standards might be lower than desired. So, for example, if you create a report and you make a big deal out of it, or maybe in the meeting you spend a lot of time discussing the markets, and which we recommend not doing. We reject doing this. But let's say you think it's important to give an update of the market and a projection of where you think the markets or the world events or how they're going to affect the markets or whatever, things like that. Let's say you feel conversations like that are important and you make a big deal to make sure that those conversations occur at a meeting. If in the client's mind, they connect the dots and they go, A, I don't think you can predict future markets, and B, what do the markets have to do with me specifically anyway? I realize that we all live in a world that everything's affected by world events, but I'm more interested in my stuff, my goals. How am I doing? Am I on track? Am I off track? So the conversations could be a complete miss. And if you make a big deal out of things, including conversations, but anything you provide, reports or anything that doesn't matter to the client, you're actually advertising that your standards might be lower than theirs. So it's their standards, which you have to make the effort to understand and then live up to and exceed. Okay, fourth of the fundamental laws, the more successful and affluent the client, the higher their standards are for the client experience, because that's what got them where they are today. They made different choices. So if you want to work with them, you have to raise your game. And if you do, if you actually pull that off, you'll be surrounded by clients, like potential clients like this. So here's the answer to your actual question. It's not so much about the fee, like $20,000 versus $100,000. It's all about the client's standards. So there's a cliche, and I'm going to quote it. Sometimes I like cliches, but there is a cliche that says cost is only an issue in the absence of value. And of course, what that means is, you know, $100,000 is only expensive if the client who's paying it doesn't think they're getting enough value to be worth it. But if, for example, a client paying $100,000 per year to their advisor, if they feel like they're getting $200,000 worth of value, and oh, by the way, in their old relationship with advisors paying money management fees and everything, they were paying $300,000 or $400,000 before, and now they're paying $100,000. I'm just giving you some hypotheticals. Then their value exceeds the price. Okay, so the cost. But anyway, the point I'm making is that if you assume that a client who feels that $100,000 per year fee is reasonable for all the value that's being provided to them, and you're assuming that that $100,000 client has higher standards than a client who feels $20,000 per year as a fee paid to the advisor is reasonable, Well, then yes, there is a difference, but I would say that kind of misses the point. You can assume that all you want. The issue I would put on the table is, but you know, is it conceivable in your mind that a client who's paying $20,000 per year actually has higher standards than a client paying $100,000 a year? Yes, that is definitely conceivable. I've seen situations like that among my own clients. And that's the point, that standards are a very individual thing. But generally, yes, you can make the case, the more successful and the more affluent the client, the higher the standards. So the point is, you have to make a commitment to identify the standards for each and every client and then make it your goal, your objective, your mission in life to exceed those standards for each individual client. And yes, the more successful and affluent the client, typically the higher their standards are. That is true. And the fifth fundamental law is that if you accept the idea that a client will only be impressed with an advisor whose standards are higher than their own, then what that means is that your client experience is determining who wants to be your client. That's just another way of saying that your current level of referrals tells the whole story about what's going on with your client experience. So if your calendar currently is filled with meetings with potential clients, all of whom were introduced to you by well-served clients, I can tell you with 100% certainty that's due to the client experience that you're delivering. That just doesn't happen by accident. It's a total direct correlation with the fact that you're delivering an extraordinary client experience, and therefore your clients feel no risk in, you know, sticking their neck out and recommending you to people that they care about, and therefore your calendar is filled. So if you're getting a lot of referrals, then it's due to the client experience that you're delivering. If you're not receiving referrals, or many referrals, or if you're not receiving enough referrals to make that your sole method of growing your business, that typically is also due to your client experience. So it may be that you don't have enough clients. I would accept that. But at some point, that's the goal, to have enough clients and to be exceeding their standards sufficiently that they refer you to everyone they know and love and care about. And so there is a measure for this, and that's where I'm going to cover this. There's one final sixth fundamental law, but I want to leave you with this point. This is where we were heading with all of this. What you should be measuring, there is a single most important metric that you need to track to measure whether or not your standards are exceeding your clients or not. This is something you should start this week and immediately start tracking. We recommend that you track it. You can update it as often as you want, but at least on a monthly basis, because there is a direct correlation between this number, the annual referral rate, and whether or not you're exceeding your client's standards or not. Okay, so what is it? Here's the formula. You take the total number of ideal client referrals over the last 12 months. Now, for some of you that are newer to the program, even the term ideal client you're not clear on what that is. So that's covered in the annual recurring revenue exercise, which is a very early project that we give you. And so an ideal client is really your best client. It's think of all your clients and eliminate the ones that you either dislike working with, or they're just not paying you enough to be profitable. So you'll get a more refined definition for ideal client later, but let's just say you have this community of ideal clients, however many that is, and so you figure out how many referrals did you receive from that community over the last 12 months. So you take those referrals and you divide it by the total number of ideal clients, and that is the annual referral rate. So it's the number of referrals divided by the number of clients. That's your annual referral rate. You calculate the number, you carry it out 3 decimal points. You track the number like a stock, you chart it and graph it over time. And it's the trend that really matters. It's not any single calculation at any single point in time. It's the trend that matters. And the point is to update the number monthly and to make this number famous in your team. So you make sure it's updated at least monthly, and you circulate the graph or the chart, you know, around to your team at least monthly. So it's not the annual referral rate, the individual number that matters. It's the trend, and an upward trend is definitely good, and a downward trend is usually a sign of dysfunction, not always. But what it really means is if you start seeing your annual referral rate level off or go down, what you'll learn over time is that it's worth the time and effort to stop and troubleshoot what's happening, to invest the time necessary to figure out what's going on. Now, we're short on time here, so I'm just going to show this to you, but this is something that'll be covered in more detail as you get into the monthly projects. But this is the method that an advisor we work with tracks this annual referral rate. This is what you're looking at here is just simply a spreadsheet. And you'll notice the annual referral rate is what's being tracked here, and then the columns are each month of the year. So you've got the annual referral rate. Remember, you take the number of referrals over the last 12 months given by your ideal clients, divided by the number of ideal clients. You carry the number out 3 decimal points. And so the annual referral rate for this advisor in January, this was last year, 0.294. February, the most recent one that we got from this advisor, was 1.59. So an annual referral rate, just to give you a hypothetical, of 1, let's say your annual referral rate was an even number, just 1. That means that over the last 12 months, on average, every ideal client provided 1 referral to you over the last year. That's and a number less than 1, like we had over here back in this January number, less than 1 means that on average, every ideal client gave you less than 1 referral over the past 12 months. So by the most recent number, it's more than 1.5. Every client on average gives more than 1.5. But the point is, it's the trend. So if you, and this advisor has done this here, if you take these numbers up on the spreadsheet and just put them on a graph, this is what it looks like. And it looks quite good for this advisor. Their annual referral rate is rising over time. That's what really matters. Now, this same advisor tracks it actually 2 ways. You notice here's the annual referral rate, same one we were just tracking, but they also have a version of this chart where they track the number of ideal clients month by month. So they're adding ideal clients. In this case, just looking at their table, they're adding about 1 a month. Lately, in the last few months, they've added more than 1 a month, but whatever, just month by month, they're tracking both the number of ideal clients currently at that point and the annual referral rate. And the point to be made here is that the number of ideal clients being added is rising, as well as the annual referral rate. And that's the dynamic that's magic. That's what you want to see. If you can pull that off, and most advisors can't, I'm telling you that straight up. This is what clients complain about. This is what the data and research shows, that as advisors are adding ideal clients, the client experience declines. In other words, I don't get as much attention now as I used to when you didn't have so many clients. You know, this is the client talking. So this is the metric. Your annual referral rate, that is the number of referrals on an annual basis being given by your clients, ideal clients, is increasing as your number of clients increases. And that is a direct correlation between the annual referral rate and whether or not you're exceeding your clients' expectations or not. And we can go through that data later. Referrals are almost never evenly distributed among your clients. They are disproportionate. So the thing I love about the annual referral rate and why it works so effectively is because it does not presume that every client gives referrals. By carrying it out 3 decimal points, it acknowledges just the opposite. And that is that most referrals are attributable to a handful, just a small number of ideal clients whose expectations are being consistently exceeded. So you have a handful, you have all these clients, and maybe there's a small handful that you actually pull it off. You're able to consistently exceed their expectations. You understand what their expectations are, and you can consistently, you know, exceed those. We call that handful of your clients that typically give most of your referrals as your marketing apostles, but that's kind of irrelevant. I just love the fact that the annual referral rate acknowledges that, you know, not every client gives referrals, so it doesn't matter. And that makes that single metric so valuable. So the final of the six fundamental laws is, if another advisor's client experience demonstrates better standards than yours, your client will switch in an instant. So this is the dynamic that we've seen in like the picking up over the last 5 to 10 years. I can tell you that having been in this business 30 years, you know, 25 years ago, an ideal client firing me and hiring another advisor was almost unheard of. I mean, there was just this sense of loyalty. And of course, we were trying to bust our butts and, you know, serve them at a high level. But, you know, this thing of if you're doing a great job, or even if the client sees that you're trying, they don't hire you. That has changed. That is reverse trend, 100%. Clients 5 years ago are firing their advisors at a much higher pace, and clients today are firing their advisors for another advisor at an even more alarming pace. And that just makes all these fundamental laws so critical that you're not living in a vacuum. There are other advisors out there who are making it their job to meet all of your clients. And if they can demonstrate that their standards are higher than yours, then there is the risk that your clients could switch in an instant. And the only reason we bring that up as the sixth fundamental law is it just shows you how high the stakes are. The stakes are high. If you think you can coast and not worry about whether your standards exceed your clients or not, that's not true. And it's increasingly becoming less true. There are other advisors out there trying to impress your client. And if they are able to pull that off, clients today are much more likely to fire you and hire the other advisor than at any other time in the past. So that being said, those are the six fundamental laws. I wanted to cover those. And yes, there is a difference between a $100,000 client and a $20,000 client. The funny thing is, over on our other system, the more advanced system, the Trusted Advisor Toolkit, whether an advisor is being compensated $20,000 a year, $25,000 a year, or $100,000 a year, they're delivering all the same sets of services. So over here in the Advisor Pack Monthly program, you know, we kind of teach you how to fish. We show you how to go out, build a team, build your own deliverables, checkpoints, and deliverables for a client. But for members of the more advanced program, and I'm not trying to sell you on it, I just have promised consistently that we would give you a peek into the more advanced program whenever we think it would help you over here. All I'm trying to say is over in the Trusted Advisor Toolkit, we have 142 specific deliverables checkpoints. And so that is the definition of comprehensive financial services in the toolkit. So the point I'm making is whether an advisor on the toolkit is charging $100,000 per client per year, they're delivering the same 142 deliverables checkpoints. It's the same checkpoints. But the point to be made is, to your question, is can you deliver those 142 deliverables checkpoints to exceed your client's standards at a $20,000, $25,000, $100,000? Can you deliver those same 142 deliverables checkpoints in a way that a client paying you $100,000 a year would look at that and say, wow, that's a bargain. I'd be happy to pay $100,000 a year for that. And the best, I think, metaphor for this is an airline. One time, I've flown a lot in my life. I've lived in Europe. I've lived in South America when I was a kid. And maybe 10 years ago, I flew to New Delhi. It was a 17-hour flight. They served six meals, and they had three classes of service. They had first class, business class, and coach. I was in business class. Now, back in coach, they were packed in very tight on this airline. It was a very nice, it was a great airline. But still, back in coach, the seats were five across in, several rows. I mean, five. It was packed like a cattle car. I was in business class. Now, that was very nice. My seat reclined all the way flat. I had a bed, and I could sleep through the whole flight, and I did, by the way. That was business class. But I went up, and I took a tour, and I peeked into first class, and up there, that was just blew my mind. Those people had their own cabins. It was like they had their own little apartments. It was unbelievable. So we all got to New Delhi safely. Everybody on that seven-hour flight, you know, got on the plane and got off safely. The question is the experience. Can you deliver a, you know, $20,000, $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 experience? I think it makes perfect sense when you think about the different classes of service that you could deliver the same, let's call it 142 deliverables checkpoints, in different ways and elevated in such a way that it exceeds your client's standards substantially enough to charge an extraordinarily high fee. And that's the only point that I'm making. So your instincts are right. There is a difference. And to provide $100,000 of value versus $20,000 of value per year, there is a difference. It's just that it's going to be up to you to work with your clients to establish their standards and therefore exceed those. Well, that's it for the Advisor Pack monthly session for this month. Until next month, we wish you all the best in implementing. I'm Mark Little.